What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either.
Really.
Say scratch that again.
Scratch that again.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode, and also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here.
Hi, friends.
Happy Monday.
Hello.
You guys, today we have with us one of the most beloved couples on the internet. I don't feel like that's hyperbole.
Wow.
The real life Shane and Hannah Burkaw. This is not a trick. It's real. They're here with us and they're on the other side of the screen. We're so happy to have you guys here with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
So excited to be here.
Most beloved couple on the internet.
Don't you think, though? I don't think that's too debatable. Okay.
I'm going to draw a little award. That's what the cover for this will be. Most beloved.
That sets the bar really high for this interview.
Yeah.
Now we have to behave so belovedly.
I'm assuming that our people already know who you are and recognize their voices immediately, but you might also know them as Squirmy and Grubs from their absurdly popular YouTube channel. They've done a ton of work in the world of disability advocacy, and they brought people into the real life, everyday moments of disability, and especially with their recent book, but also with their YouTube channel, kind of bringing people into inter-abled relationships. The new book that they had that just came out is called Inter-Abled. I'm holding it reverently. True Stories About Love and Disability from Squirmy and Grubs and Other Inter-Abled Couples. We'll talk about it more today, and we'll have a link for it in our show notes. But you both are, okay, I'm like, how do I introduce you with my genuine gushing heart without setting you up to feel like you need to perform? Funny and warm and doing a million and 10 things every day. So thank you for taking the time to chat with us today.
We really appreciate it. We're big fans as well. So it's an honor to be here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. We like to start every interview by asking about little you. So here on Scratch That, we're really talking about reparenting ourselves, little people, both our children or children in general, our adult selves, how that intersects. So we would love to hear, who were little Hannah and little Shane? And this is a little extra thing I'm going to add on to it, which we'll talk about later, but I'm obsessed with you guys' humor and the chemistry that comes from that. And so I'm curious what role humor played in your childhoods, however you want to talk about that.
Great question. All right. Do you want to talk about little Hannah?
Oh,
or do you want me to talk about little Shane?
Are you ready?
I remember yesterday, literally yesterday, you remembered and said to me, I was such a pesky little kid.
Oh, yeah.
You were just like remembering that you were a pesky kid.
Yeah. Well, like that kind of goes into the role of humor because I was I was super shy, like a very, very shy kid, unless I was comfortable like with the people I was around.
Yeah.
And so for like third to sixth grade, I was in a school where like the same 18 kids moved each year. So I was very comfortable. And that was what I was talking about is like I was very much a class clown type, like pestering the teacher, trying to make people laugh. Like, and thinking back, it's mortifying because I was so like interruptive. It was just like awful things.
She would go to the classroom where they had a pet like guinea pig.
Yeah.
Each day, and she would get it and just bring it with her from class to class. Like not letting the teacher.
I mean, no, like the teacher who had the guinea pig knew I had the guinea pig. Like I was trusted with it. But like the teachers in the classes I took it to did not know. I would just have it like under the desk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what else? You were a swimmer.
Yes, I was a swimmer.
That was kind of the main.
Since I was five. I was a year-round like competitive swimmer. So that was probably the biggest part of my life. But I don't want it to come across that I was a bad kid because I was very well-behaved except for like a little bit of joking behavior.
So this day is a rule follower through and through.
Yeah,
the fact that she took the guinea pig and shot it into me. It's because that teacher allowed it.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to picture how this works. Like, how did you keep it from running and peeing? And
oh, no, it was like a very calm, it just liked to be petted. So it would sit in my lap under the desk.
It wasn't alive. It was just.
Oh, the missing piece, a dead guinea pig. Oh, it all makes sense.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder how much better all children would learn if they just had a little warm creature to pet. Like, that was probably really soothing and grounding for you.
There's a reason I wanted the guinea pig. It was warm on my lap. I remember the feeling of the guinea pig.
And I think that's another kind of foundation of Hannah is like amazing with animals. Yeah. Every animal loves her. She loves
obsessed
every animal.
Animals, yeah.
Obsessed with animals. So that tracks, yeah.
Do you want to talk about Little Shane?
Little Shane. I'm like hesitant to call him a shithead.
Oh.
He was a little bit of it. Like, he was a class clown as well. Also a rule follower. I think that's interesting about our dynamic. We were really like wanted to make everyone laugh, but not in a way that would get us in trouble.
Yeah.
one of my early memories or a memory that I have from my parents is that I began learning how to use a powered wheelchair when I was 2 years old. So like straight up a baby. And at my preschool, I had like OTs and PTs come in to do these wheelchair lessons with me. And it was this really like simple wheelchair that had four directional arrows to like train a baby that you're going to move yourself now. And apparently my favorite thing to do quickly became running into people, running into walls, just causing mayhem in whatever way I could. So that was like early me.
That makes sense. Yeah.
I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
I was super, and this is true of Hannah as well, super communicative from a pretty young age. I had to be. And my parents did a really good job of instilling in me like autonomy and like communication skills to be able to explain to kids and adults why I used a wheelchair, basically. Mm-hmm. So I was very talkative.
Yeah. Early reader. I was going to say, like, that going back to little Hannah, to give a fuller picture, I one weekend told my parents when I was like, I think I was four, that I was going to like learn to read a chapter, but like I wanted to read Harry Potter essentially. And I was like, I'm going to learn to read it. So I went in my room alone for the whole weekend and read the Harry Potter book. And I was like, came out being like, I learned to read. So, like,
wait, when you were four?
Mm hmm.
Caitlin, that's Charlie and Otto.
Yeah.
We're learning to read Mom and Dad.
But I was also, but then I was like, but I want to read Harry Potter. Because like probably my brother was reading Harry Potter. Like, I don't know why I picked that, but I was like, I'm going to read it.
Yeah.
And I decided that I would. And I feel like you were like a reader.
That's so interesting. We are listening to Harry Potter. I have a 4.5-year-old and he's obsessed. But now I'm like, maybe I should stop letting him listen to it and just hand him the books and be like, well, if you want Harry Potter, figure it out.
You also had the book on tape.
I did have the book on tape. I loved it.
Oh, that probably helped. I wonder if okay, great. This is very informative. I'm going to take these. We'll see if we can get Charlie to learn to read.
I think the only other kind of like thing about my kind of growing up was that, and we don't have to yet. I don't know how serious about it yet. But the early like youth of my life, I think, was marked by a desire to like hide my disability or minimize it as much as I could. I didn't have a great kind of love for myself. And I was embarrassed of my disability. Not embarrassed. Like I just knew what it made people do. I knew how it made people treat me. So I really wanted to be not disabled. And I think that comes through in like some of the early writing I did, but I just like to say that because it shows that you can like grow and learn to love yourself, and it might happen later in life. But
Shane, I I really resonated. I felt like there were, you didn't say that explicitly in this book, but I felt like some of the threads of that with like your burden complex also.
Yeah.
I just felt like this tether to you of that child with a disability. And oh, I have that. So there's, it's so deeply rooted in me.
Yeah.
And the way that you're describing like learning to be this super communicator, and part of that skill is being this way of like, being able to maybe control the way people see you. And part of that is like, I'm gonna make you see me as a human so that you don't look at this wheelchair and you're looking at me as a human and trying to be seen as quote unquote normal. All of that I relate to so heavily.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder about this book that you just wrote. So I think I'm gonna tee up this question. There's so many things I want to ask you that I feel like I'm like cramming three questions into one. But I'm thinking about a couple of things here. I'm thinking about little Hannah and little Shane that grew up and found each other and then started telling stories together through this medium of YouTube. And then this shift that you've made recently. And I know, Shane, you've also written other books. So it's not like a totally foreign medium. But thinking about as a couple, creating in this medium of YouTube and then shifting to a book. And not only a book that tells your story, but a book that welcomes like all of these beautiful, complicated, different range of interabled relationships. And I'm curious about what that shift in medium and that shift in process, shift in who's included in that story has felt for you in creating content or stories around interabled relationships. I feel like I'm being unfair in how much I'm cramming into that question.
Oh, this is a Jerry Josh.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm gonna let Hannah answer.
I mean, first, I think that like our YouTube videos very much led into the book, like the idea for the book, because we got so many comments that we still like get from people thinking that we are extremely unique. Like we're the only couple like us out there. So they either like don't believe it or they're like, wow, this is so amazing. Like whatever they, you know, take away from it, they often think that we're like the only one. So I think that was the main inspiration behind the book, is just like telling people like we're not that unique. Like there's a lot of other people out there.
Yeah.
So.
I agree. I think that also the making of YouTube videos began as a hobby. Like, we didn't set out to be disability advocates in the beginning. You know, we're part of that community. We've always been, but like, we didn't set out with a mission. Mm-hmm. We were just making silly little videos. And then once we blew up and began receiving kind of all this attention, much of which was negative, it kind of spurred our decision to have a mission and to make more message-driven videos. And that ultimately, I think, worked its way into the book.
Mm-hmm.
Just another platform to help improve the way society understands disability.
Yeah.
Can I ask a follow-up question here? I'm picturing like you making these YouTube videos and getting all these comments that make it seem like you're so exceptional. Did you, and then you open up this, call for stories from people, right? Like inviting people to share their stories of interabled relationships. And I think it was something like you got like over 600 submissions in less than 24 hours or something.
Yeah, it was a crazy number. Yeah, we had turned off the form. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm curious if that surprised you. Like you were aware that you were not the only ones, but was there anything surprising or did it shift your perspective at all, not only to see so many people wanting to like tell their stories, but also to like sit with so many different stories? And I think you knew a lot of these people before, but I'm just curious about if what that felt like to you individually and as a couple to sit with so many different stories that actually have a lot of overlap with you.
The first reaction was, uh-oh.
What have we done?
Yeah.
Oh no, what have we done?
Because then you have to go through all of the submissions and like pick out just, you know, 30 or so out of all the hundreds. So that was really hard.
I didn't, yeah, when you asked about like how did we sit with that, like it was really difficult. to take 600 incredible stories and have to narrow that down.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible. Like,
yeah.
We could have swapped every chapter in this book for another great couple from our submission form.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, it did change our perspectives. I think we hoped that we would get a good response, but deep down, we were worried that we might get like 10
yeah.
submissions.
I mean, and, we hoped we would get 30 to like fill all the spots, right? You know?
Yeah. And it's interesting how you see the people that put themselves online, you know, but you don't see everyone else. Mm-hmm. And like most people aren't documenting their lives in a, you know, content creator kind of way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was eye-opening mm-hmm. in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
Rebecca and I talk a lot about what is the value of us being online and why are we sharing things. And we both keep coming back to like representation. The internet was a place that I first started seeing queer people. It was where I was like, oh, you can be queer and you can be a parent. Oh, like it's where I found a lot of support around ADHD and neurodivergence. And so what makes you keep showing up to tell your stories?
Shane, you mentioned, I mean, like a lot of the comments that you guys get are awful. Like you are confronting like some of the shittiest corners of the internet. And like reading some of them in the book, I've seen like you've documented them in other places, but like just like gathering them together in the book is just like kind of makes me hate humanity sometimes. And yet you keep sharing. It's so generous of you. And also no one would blame you if you were like, and we're done.
This is an ever evolving
mm-hmm. topic
for us.
For sure.
It's something that's at the forefront of daily life. You know, we talk about it constantly
mm-hmm.
and we have periods where we're like, we're done. You know what? This is annoying, not worth it. But then we also have really amazing moments where like we hear stories from people that, you know, whose lives we've improved in some way, or a couple that is together because they both watch their videos together.
Yeah.
Like there's plenty of amazing and positive things that happen as well that kind of keep us going.
Yeah, you know what's funny is whenever we do anything in person, like we just did a book signing at the Abilities Expo, or like we've done things like that over the years. And after those, like on the car ride home, at least I think both of us, but we feel so like pumped about what we're doing. Like it's such a revitalizing thing to hear people be like,
yeah,
I love your video so much, and like actually see them, because we do get way more positive comments than negative, but like obviously the negative ones are very noticeable to us.
Stand out.
Yeah. So to have like people come up and like say how much they like our videos makes us, I think that's one of the things that like always keeps us going, is that there are so many people that do enjoy the videos. And then there's also the hope that like seeing like the people who leave the negative comments, like I'm hopeful that if they just keep seeing us pop up, or people that look like us, like, you know, people of any like disability, inter-abled thing, like if they just keep seeing that enough, like maybe eventually it'll wear off and they'll just like stop
like
saying horrible things.
Exposure therapy.
Yeah, they'll be like, okay, like yes, this is actually a thing, like whatever. So I'm hopeful that like even if it's just our videos that get like all the hate, like maybe we can just kind of tire them out eventually. Yeah.
And I think that like we've done a good job of protecting our mental health in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, it was the Wild West out there. We were just reading every comment and replying to trolls, and it was just like a lot of anger and sadness. Nowadays, we have better systems where, like, because Hannah feels more emotionally like affected by it, she doesn't really read comments. Like, I kind of give her the highlights. I try not to get into arguments with people online, like, because it never ends well.
Yeah.
Things like that. Just like being careful about how we're interacting with the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that exposure therapy idea, I don't know. I think that there's something about that that makes a lot of sense to me. Because I guess here's my next question. And I think there's maybe a lot of ways to think about this, but it is odd to me. And I feel this in a lot of arenas around disability and like misconceptions and like the stories written over our life experiences, where it's just like, how are so many people getting this so wrong or understanding this so inaccurately?
or see this as such a fringe, rare experience? Like, how do people still think that? So I guess my question is, in part, like, you are experiencing the profound commonality, the prevalence, the ubiquitousness, the ubiquity of interabled relationships. And I'm curious if you have any theories as to why something that is so common, not only like for young people, but also just in, if you want to stay partnered with someone in the long run, the chances that your relationship is going to include disability are very high, right? Like, this is a common experience. Caregiving in relationships is a common experience. Why do we still have such a massive roadblock in being able to see disability and romance or relationship as being coupled? Like, what is the huge roadblock there? Why is it so hard to understand? Do you have any theories? Have you hypothesized about that?
That's a huge question.
Yeah.
So whatever I'm about to say, take it with a grain of salt. But I think that part of it, there's probably a million parts to it, but part of it is that I think caregiving is still seen as sort of inherently a bad, negative feeling to be avoided. Even though when we hear stories of a partner caring for their spouse through sickness and injury, whatever, it's said in a, like, oh, they sacrificed. They did this hard, bad thing because they love their partner.
Mm-hmm.
It's not seen as
like, yeah, a normal part of a relationship.
Oh, yeah. So I think because we're saying publicly, caregiving is a great part of our relationship. It's not, and Hannah's not an angel. I'm not a burden to her. Like, it's just a nice, fun part of our life. People have a real hard time feeling like agreeing with that because they maybe saw their dad care for their mom near the end of, you know, as they got older, and that was a bad thing in their family. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's part of it. We need to change the narrative that caregiving is a sacrifice that should be made.
It's interesting because I feel like if you're with a partner and then they become disabled, then there's a whole like, that's so amazing that they stayed together. But like, if you met them when they're disabled, like, that's no longer that. Like, then it's, you shouldn't be together. Like, why would you pick that person? Like, you know, it's such an odd dynamic. Like, I feel like we've talked about this so much of, like, why is it so?
I think, yeah, it's also a lack of experience with disability. Like, people think my life is so much worse than it is. So I think if they hung out with me for, like, a week and saw what my normal day-to-day life is like, a lot of those negative beliefs about disability would disappear.
Which is why we make that content.
Yeah.
You know?
So I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just had a flashback while you guys were talking. I got married when I was really young to my high school boyfriend, and I just had this flashback to one of the wedding speeches that someone gave, and in it, the groomsman said something about, like, you know, most guys wouldn't stay or something like that. And I was like, and as a 22-year-old bride or whatever, I remember that, like, hitting and hurting and in this moment of, like, celebration. And then I kind of remember just, like, thinking, of course, like the narrative of that is so prominent. And as someone who, like, knew nothing about disability as an identity, didn't know anything about disability pride or culture, it was just sort of like, oh yeah, that's the lump that I need to swallow, you know, like, because it's so deeply, that narrative is so deeply ingrained. But what I like what you are pointing to, Shane, is kind of like this larger narrative, not that we necessarily have about disability and relationships, but maybe even broader, like what we imagine a relationship at all to be. And maybe even broader than that, of just like the high value we place as a culture on independence, as like the end all be all. And like a very specific brand of independence, because we all are all still like getting our food from farmers and
Uber Eats, right? Like, we're not really independent, but there's a certain version of it that we like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The version that like can mow the lawn and, you know, cut the wood for the fire.
Yes.
No, I think you're spot on there. And that's a big recurring theme in the comments that we get is like this view of relationships that's transactional in a purely physical sense. Like,
and like gender roles and stereotypes for sure.
Yeah.
Like what you should be able to do for me.
And it ignores all of the emotional and mental and like practical aspects of a relationship.
Yeah.
That, I don't know. That, again, it's, I think the reason why disability makes that relationship better because I have to support Hannah in other ways. I'm not doing the dishes. I'm making her laugh while she's doing the dishes.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of closeness. Yeah. I don't remember what the question
was. Yes. But that was so apparent in this book. Like the value, the good disruption of disability as being like, oh, you know, all those assumptions and like gender norms, like deeply ingrained. Let's just like blow those up and figure out what we want to do for us.
Yeah.
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show. Shane, when you started talking about like devaluing care work, today we just aired an episode with Laura Danger, who runs a podcast all about like domestic care, and how we how deeply devalued it is and how gendered. There's something here about the way people are so pissed off about your two's relate like care in your relationship and the way that we devalue people who give care. Like, as parents, like once a like birthing body, someone presumed to be a woman, has a kid, like their role and the things that they're responsible for suddenly like lowers them in their like in the hierarchy of what they're valued for or their contribution to society. This is all muddled, but I think there's something like crossing. There's an intersection here between like disability and care and just like care in general.
I agree. And I think that's probably why the caregiving crisis or the landscape of caregiving is so bad out there, because it's a it's a profession that like doesn't get a lot of respect.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because we get like one of the main comments we get is that I'm like giving up my life for Shane. Like, why would she be in this relationship ruining her life? Like, that's just like one of the most common things we get. And I think that's interesting because they're just like, that's straight up saying like being a caregiver is ruining your life.
Yeah.
You know, and like I never even like thought to dissect that and be like, why do you think? I mean, I know obviously like I disagree with that, and like we'll just be like, but I've never really thought about it in the caregiving sense. I've always thought about it in like the disability sense, like being with Shane, because I think disabled people are worth less than a non-disabled partner, you know?
Like, but if you were just working for a disabled person, like, and that was your daily life, would they frown upon
that? Well, true. Well, like probably a little bit, but probably less than if it's my husband.
But it would be in a more like,
she's making
it's
money.
So nice like, of you to like do that as your job, that sad job. You know? Like, I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting. Mm.
It's making me think also, have you either of you read Sarah Hendren's book, What Can a Body Do?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's one of my all-time favorites. It's really like flipping the script on a lot of default narratives that we have around disability. But one of the things that I think her oldest son has Down syndrome. And one of the things I've heard her talk about is how culturally we have a really a strong aversion to holding any sort of obligation to another person. Like the idea that you would be obligated or that you would be tethered to caring for someone. This comes up for her a lot with people being critical of her for having more children. So her oldest son has Down syndrome and people have said like how unfair of you to have more children because they're going to be burdened by him, his caring for him in the future. And her argument is like culturally, there is so much harm done when we view the obligation to care for someone as a negative thing, that like there is something of tremendous, like the obligation or duty to other humans is actually good for society, that we would foster those values is actually benefiting us as communities, that we are beholden to each other, that we are tethered to other people that require care. That is not a bad thing. That's a valuable thing, which is such a, I don't know, it makes me curious about other cultures. It seems like a very American thing that we would see that as like, oh, they're being weighted down, as opposed to like, oh, there is value in this relationship.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, similar but different. We have talked a little bit about how we are like totally codependent on each other, and that's usually seen as a negative thing, but for us it's like our favorite thing about our relationship, that like even now we feel like such a strong
desire to be together,
to be near each other, and yeah, like to do everything together.
Yeah,
and people think that's a bad thing, and you should
doesn't feel like a bad thing,
feels like a great thing. I feel lucky.
Well, also I was gonna say, this is kind of changing the subject, but very similar like reception in society is we a couple years ago bought a house with my parents. Mm. Like after the pandemic, we were like, why are we living 15 minutes apart? Like this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
like,
we visit you every day.
We wanted to spend our winters away. So like it just fit our life perfectly to be like, we're going to live with them in Minnesota and then someone can be at our house and like we can leave, we travel a lot, whatever. But we got a lot of comments being like people thinking it was a step backwards, like mm-hmm. they need to live with her parents because of his disability, like whatever, you know, idea they had, it was just not really welcome. And I feel like in other cultures, it's obviously very much a normal thing to live with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And you know what it's making me all think of is like, oh, suddenly we're like, why are we in a loneliness pandemic? Everyone's so lonely in America, you know, in U.S. communities. And it's like, so we don't want to be obligated to anyone or anything. And we can't live with other people. Why are we so lonely? I don't know.
Yeah, that's wrong.
Well, it's like there's this one very specific way that it's supposed to look like. Like you're supposed to like move out. You're supposed to find someone. You're supposed to get married. You're supposed to have a kid. You're supposed to have your own house. And it doesn't take into account for any of the peculiarities or personal needs or things, which is something that this is like maybe a little shift. But in reading the book, in the interviews that you guys had with other couples, the question of like what makes a good relationship or a strong one, it was like almost everyone was like communication. And what that question, when you like went into it, what I was hearing was non-assumption, like being really direct and honest about what we need or want or what feels good to us specifically versus what are the defaults. What are the assumptions? And that feels like this gift of disability. And this feels like something that I talk about in like queer spaces where it's like that too disrupts this like one path and like forces you to have to just talk, to not assume, to not presume that you know exactly who's going to do the dishes or like who does, you know, or like just to add on to it, sorry, I just like I love the way you guys talk about sex in this book. And you bring that up specifically in that chapter about like the assumptions about like what sex should look like and how we will have it. And that like queerness brings and disability both are like, actually, what are the other ways to experience this? What do we want? What feels good to you? Like that being the premise as opposed to like, we already know what this looks like and how it's we do it. And anyways. So I don't know if you guys want to speak more to some of the gifts of it or how you experience that sort of like disruption and how what it brings your relationship to have some of those assumptions disrupted.
Yes, that's the question. Like, how does disruption, like, what is the gift of that in a relationship?
Yeah.
That's a Jay Shasha.
This just makes me think, we did a speaking engagement in Seattle, and a couple came up to us afterwards, and they were both non-disabled. And it was a husband and wife. And he said he have no experience with disability before this. Like, this, your videos have been like my first exposure, and it's made such a big difference in my relationship with my wife. Like, our relationship has totally transformed based on the things that we've heard you talking about. Yeah. And which was so like crazy and really nice to hear, because we have talked about this a lot. I do feel like the fact that we just like had to talk about things and tailor things to how they'll work perfectly for us.
Yeah.
Was such a gift, you know, versus just the assumptions.
I remember, like, just a small story. When Hannah came to visit me in Pennsylvania for the first time, you know, we met online, we were 1,000 miles apart, and for like 2.5 months, 3 months?
2 months.
2 months.
I feel like I've told you that it was two months like on the day. I feel like you should know that by
now. 2 months on the day.
I've said it so many times.
2 months on the day, Hannah came to visit. And like our first moment of like intimacy, you know, I was like, okay, do you want to like lay and watch a movie together? Like, cute, cuddle, whatever. Sure, that's adorable. All right, well, you're going to have to lift me. Yeah. Like, and I'm going to have to now teach you how to lift me. That is such a thing that, like, people that don't have experience with it might view that moment as, like, she had to, like, do all, like, learn to pick him up. Like, that's weird. But for us, it was this hilarious, like, cute moment where I'm, like, describing how to lift me, and she's not wanting to hurt me.
Yeah.
So she's, like, being real careful and just like a cute, lovely moment that, you know, is so far outside the realm of what people think a relationship should look like.
And just in like day-to-day life, the household chores that we split. Mm-hmm. I feel like if couples really sat down and talked about what they prefer to do, like, they could be a little bit happier versus like what they're,
assigned society
to do. Yeah, exactly. Because like, I prefer, like, I don't mind taking out the trash cans. I'm not making a phone call and I'm not paying a bill. Like, this worked really well for us, you know?
Yeah. I also think it has a downside, and that is we are both so uber focused on like what the other one wants that like we can't decide what to order for dinner.
Well, that's the biggest
problem. So, yeah, what do you want?
The dinner problem is a huge issue. We'll fight. We'll be like, just say what you want.
I say, I am not assuming anything that you want. Tell them.
That is a consistent fight over here.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But of all the fights to have, I think we can. I don't know. Uh-huh. It's making me think. Okay, so we talk a lot on this podcast about like script writing and the default scripts we inherit and how we write our own scripts for ourselves. And like the way you're talking about this is like you are sort of I'm literally like picturing the screenplay of the romance moment where you're teaching Hannah how to lift you, right? Like you're writing a new script for a love story. You're writing a new script for domestic partnership. And what's striking me, and this is maybe kind of going back to an earlier part of the conversation, but it's striking me how you are writing this script and then you're sharing that with this enormous audience. And then there's so many people in that audience that are projecting their script back onto you, right? And they're like, this doesn't fit the script, and this is why that makes me so angry. And you even said at one part in the book, I think I loved this line so much. You said, I think it was actually in the chapter where you're talking about poop, which I loved. Like, yes, let's talk about poop. But you were, it was sort of like thinking about all of the care work and how that fits into romance. And you said, it's very simple. The image of us as perceived by strangers has no influence whatsoever on the reality of our situation. Telling a squirrel it's a rabbit does not make it a rabbit. And I felt really emotional reading that because, I mean, my audience and what I share online is so much smaller than you guys. But and even when I'm just out in the world with my son, like I'm so aware of the scripts that people write over me. And I do not have hundreds of thousands of comments
happening. And I think about this, the script writing that our audience is doing, and how many of them would relate to that feeling of like, we're living in this script we're writing. This is our reality. This is true. And then there are these other stories that come on to us. And I'm just wondering, how do you hold on to yourselves without letting that voice, those scripts, those narratives, like, infiltrate this thing that you're building? How has that been for you?
Well, like, my first thought is that just that idea alone is something that we use to feel better. Like, I'll read a comment and I'll be like, well, they are wrong. Like, I know what is true.
Yeah.
Like, I know that our relationship is this. And the fact that they're saying something else, like, it literally does not. It's just wrong.
And sometimes it's so, like, oftentimes it's so wrong that we derive humor out of it. Like,
yeah.
Well, like, they write us an essay about reasons why our relationship is bad. None of them are true.
Yeah.
They've just made them up. And it's a little bit funny that that person spent 20 minutes just being wrong, 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 like, and telling the world about it.
Yeah.
Totally agree. I think it's been sort of a lifelong process for me. Like, that exact thing that you're talking about, people putting their scripts onto you, is the kind of thing that I struggled with when I was younger. So, like, a memory I have is being at the beach with my family for family vacation. And I know that, like, my ribs look different than average rib cage. And I have skinny arms and stuff like that. So I, like, refused to take off my clothes on, like, our schedule was, like, go to the beach for the day, every day. And I wouldn't, like, play. I didn't want to go in the ocean because I didn't want people, like, seeing me. I didn't want to look and see their, like, sad faces. I didn't want to deal with, like, comments to my parents about, you know, what's wrong with him, which would happen all the time. So I just, like, went inside myself and didn't enjoy the beach. I kind of for a while, like, hated going to the beach or going to public pools because I just didn't want to be that kind of spectacle. So growing up, it was a very long, something I still, like, work on today when I'm in those moments, just reminding myself, like, what people are imagining about me right now isn't true. Like, I know what's true. I know my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'll also say, I feel like how we keep the other people's scripts from, like, infiltrating ours. I feel like both of us, like, when I look at me growing up, I've never really let, like, society's scripts determine what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Like, in 10th grade, I decided that I didn't want to do high school anymore because I didn't like my school. So I homeschooled the last 2 years of high school. Like, I just told my mom, I was like,
this is dumb.
Just, you know, I'm going to homeschool. And, like, I found a couple of programs. Like, I'm going to join these, like, in-person classes. And, like, that's what I'm doing. And that's what we did. So, like, I feel like just naturally, I'm very much like, I don't really care about whatever I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you grew up working on that at least, and then just, like, not caring.
Yeah, I mean, the lifelong accumulation of that struggle for me is just that, like, I have a thick skin.
Yeah.
Today, like, really nothing bothers me. It's, like, almost to a fault.
And
it's
like, yeah, I'm like,
you
feel
should
it.
Care a little bit more about what people think.
Just
1%.
Tiny bit.
But yeah, the outcome of all that is I just don't care anymore. Like,
yeah.
And that helps. I think it's a very useful tool for me, have it be able to, like, turn on the apathy.
Yeah. I'm curious because, Shane, the way you describe that really resonates with me as someone who's been visibly disabled since I was a tiny, tiny person. And Hannah, I like that you already had that. It's cool to hear. And I'm like, I just want to meet little Hannah and who this person was with the gerbil and her homeschooling. But, like, I'm curious if there was any sort of learning curve for you in having, because Shane was so used to the outside gaze immediately being like, what's wrong with him? And whatever, the pity gaze. Was there a learning curve with you for you in kind of being lumped into that kind of gaze?
Mm-hmm.
It's making me laugh because we have so many stories.
Like, which one? Well, I mean, first of all, absolutely. I remember the first time we went, I think you might have visited me in Minnesota the first time, and we went to the Mall of America, and like we were walking around the mall together, and everyone stares at Shane when he goes by. And I remember being so uncomfortable. Like, I didn't know if I should like glare at them or like not look, like just try to pretend like not look at anybody. Like, I didn't know what to do with myself because I was like, this is so uncomfortable. And like, obviously now I don't notice it, or if someone's staring, like I will stare back or I like don't care. But there was definitely a learning curve. But what stories are you thinking of?
Like, well, there's no one have to tell.
Cried.
Yeah, the woman that cried was a good one. I mean, we tried a few criers.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the one where Hannah ate edibles and then someone asked if you were her son. I was thinking of that one.
Was the person that asked if I was, what she said was, can I talk to your son?
Oh, that's no. What she said.
And it was like, I can't describe, but it was a literal like,
it was
witch?
A witch. I think it was a witch.
Like, I think maybe it was just in my mind, but like a witch in like long robes, like long gray hair.
Something
like,
that lived in a mountain in Lord of the
Rings. Yeah, like unbelievable, like, on the city streets. Like, I didn't understand odds of that happening.
And you were so beyond high. It was not working for your brain.
It was cool.
Oh my God.
I think, especially in the beginning, we had all these encounters that happen to me all the time. People coming up and preying on me against my will.
Or people hearing that we're dating, and like, this was a specific woman, she started to cry because it was so beautiful. She couldn't believe that I was his girlfriend.
Yeah. So like, I don't know. I don't want to speak for you, but like, when those interactions happen, we mostly let them happen, and then we try to be friendly, as friendly as we can, and then when they leave, we laugh about it together.
Yeah.
So,
I feel like we're usually just pleased that we have a funny story.
Yeah.
Like, well, that was
fun. We're like, oh, we can't wait to tell everyone.
Well, you know what that makes me think as you're talking is, like, I wonder how much the telling of the story is part of the reclaiming and taking the power and being in charge of the script. I think so much about that movie, that kids movie, Inside Out, with the memories. I'm always talking about that. You know that movie? And it's almost like the memory comes down and the other person is like trying to make it into a sad moment. And you guys come in and you're like, we are recreating this memory. And now it is funny. And we are the ones in charge of it.
Yeah.
Like the act of storytelling with the humor, that superpower you have of like your levity. I think there was another quote in the book where you said like, it was funny because we made it so. And I loved that line.
No, I think that's a really good point.
Yeah.
And something that we talk about often is like, when we have a bad experience or we have some inaccessibility issue or whatever, our first reaction is usually like, this is going to be a great video. Like, it sucks right now, but it's going to be a good video.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that is a tool that we use. Because we know like this bad life event has value. It will have value.
Yeah.
In the way that it will make other people fired up or angry or laugh or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, and the ability to make it funny. It was funny because we made it so. Like, that feels like such a defining part of what I experience in you is like just this. It reminds me of the word scrappy too. Of that, like the scrappiness that is like grabbing that story by the throat and just like making it funny. You can make anything funny.
But it also doesn't feel like you're discounting.
No.
I think there's like sometimes people like do this Pollyanna thing. And that is so not what I get from you guys. You're just like, you are so steady in who you are. And you're like, fuck this shit. And just make it, you take ownership of it without pretending that it didn't suck and that stuff isn't hard. And then you're like using that. I think humor is such a powerful tool to enact change because it's so disarming. It's such a bonding thing. And when you are laughing or finding humor, like you're moving yourself out of a trauma state. Like you can't engage in that kind of play if you're like traumatized. So it's like such an amazing tool just for like regulating yourself.
Yeah.
And then a way to connect with other people without pretending that the shit isn't so fucked up.
Really appreciate you saying that. That's like our favorite tait on what we do. Yeah. It really frustrates us when people say, I wish you wouldn't just sugarcoat everything, like not everything's a joke, stuff like that. It's like, we know that. That's not.
That was like when Shane fell off of our ramp once and the, like, he slid off and like literally almost died, like 1 inch away from death.
I was shouting, please don't let me die.
Yeah. And my mom had rescued him and it was all fine. But we told the story and I laughed like at part of it. Like, I think you were like describing how you flipped off the ramp. Like, you said some like weird description and I laughed. And there were so many comments being like, she thinks it's funny that he almost died. Like, she died. I'm like, do people not laugh about like things that happen?
Well, I think we do know that a good number of people don't have a sense of humor.
That's true.
Which I feel like that is such a tool. You're right.
Yeah.
And I think it is a bit jarring for some people when they come to our page and we're like, oh, this restaurant didn't have a ramp. Ha. Like, not that, obviously. But I think it disarms people.
Yeah.
It makes them realize we're just.
Some people get it.
Some people don't.
Well, I think that I like that you underscored that, Caitlin, because I think that that is almost a superpower to be able to hold on to the both and of those moments. I mean, because I'm even thinking about like the TSA pre-check story that you told of like the getting like the grueling attempt to like even get in the room, let alone get the fingerprints, and like how you told that story with like there. It's like the genuine LOL next to the genuine heartbreak ache. And to couple those together feels like the heart of life. And also, like, it seems like most people can only do one or the other. And it's really hard to hold on to both. And you do that so well.
Thank you. I think it's a reason why we feel so happy to be codependent with
each other. It works.
That's just how we process the world. And it's very... to get there, we both handle it that way. It would not work if one of us didn't handle it that way.
For sure.
I know I mentioned in my email that we were curious about to talk with you about IVF. I was so struck by that chapter. That's the last chapter of your book where you tell that part of the journey. And I felt such heartache as you brought us through the roller coaster of that experience. And of course, there was like the humor in it as well, you know, like the fresh samples and the fishy swimmers and all of that, you know, like there was plenty of you bringing us into moments of laughter, but like the ache of that felt real. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, I think about as partners, those life events that we go through that can be kind of big shifting points in a relationship or like defining points. I'm thinking like my partner, Micah, was diagnosed with cancer in 2020. And just like, it's one of those, you have only so many of those. I think most of us only have so many of those as couples of like these big life experiences. I'm wondering if you could speak to what that is, how that has impacted you as individuals and as a couple, like what, if there are words that you have to describe the impact of that stretch of experiences for you.
I think it strengthened our love for one another. Because like at the end of the first attempt and it didn't work, we had each other. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of like, let's take time. Like we were so laser focused on this IVF process for like a year and a half, however long it ended up being. But after it was like,
yeah, it was like a full year.
Wow, we can like go to dinner tonight and not think about a fresh sample would be uncollected tomorrow, you know, or like whatever horrible news or appointment might be around the corner.
Yeah,
it was just like nice to focus on ourselves for a bit.
Yeah, I also feel like because we haven't. Like, we left the book off. I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but, like, I mean, obviously, the IVF round, like, didn't work. And then we haven't since then really made any, like, moves or decisions. We've just been, like, in the same place with that. And, like, mm-hmm. every once in a while, we'll discuss, like, do we want to have kids? Like, do we want to try again? Like, what would that look like? That kind of a thing. So I feel like like, I'm not even sure what my answer is because it doesn't feel like it's done. It doesn't feel like over it. Yeah. We didn't like close it. So I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think, okay, maybe I'm wrong. I think when it failed officially, it felt over. Like, it felt like, oh my God, this is a failure. It's not in the hearts for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, now we are at a point, you know, a year or two removed, where we're still like, well, we should try again. We should, like,
yeah,
you know, if we want to, if not, oh well.
Yeah.
Like, we're very much in the phase right now of, like, we are really enjoying life without children.
Yeah.
And we knew it then, but we really know it now that, like, we have to be, like, on board. Like,
yeah.
We have to be like, let's do this. You know, we're not going to go into it lightly.
Yeah.
And we're just enjoying life. And I think that's, like, the good part. And maybe something for others who are going through it to realize is that, like, it might feel like if it doesn't work that you're not going to be able to be, like, happy or whatever, but we are. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, we got through it and we're happy again.
Yeah. 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 I love that, that, like, coming, so you, like, have this intense year where you're focused on this, like, potential future that you're moving toward. And then when you put a pause on that, coming back to each other and not feeling a lack, but feeling a joyfulness in the life that you have right now. And the way you described that, Shane, with, like, the relief that we get to just go to dinner.
Yeah.
And I...
For 6 months after the failure, we would often be watching a movie at night at, like, 11 p.m. And we would just say out loud, can you imagine if there was a baby, like,
crying and interrupting us?
Like, yeah. Yeah, we'd be going to bed and we'd be like, imagine if we weren't going to sleep through the night.
What were we thinking?
Yeah, so that helped. Yeah, we would just. And it was like our hypothetical baby was the worst baby ever.
Well, and I also like the way that you talk about that, like, it felt like it was over. And then with a little bit of more distance, you're like, there are so many options, so many paths. And I think we can get really locked in into feeling like this one way and this one time is the only thing. And if we can allow ourselves to be open to trying again or trying a different way or imagining parenting in a different way, you know, like all the different options, it feels like a beautiful picture too for us, for our listeners to
thinking about. I think, yeah, it's something that I really love about us is that, like, when however life goes, we figure out how to do it together.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? In a way that we're happy.
Really good pivoters. Yeah.
We're adapters. Yeah.
Adapters. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's this, like, trickster energy that we love to talk about. Rebecca kind of talks about it in the scrappy term. I've, like, really clung to the, like, trickster card in tarot. And it's, for me, like, Liz Gilbert talks about it as stubborn gladness. And it's just, like, this insistence on joy and, like, not pretending like it isn't hard, but also being like, I'm not going to get stuck here. Like, I will slither and move and pivot and adapt. And, like, I will find the light. And it's it feels like a really incredible act of resistance.
We did an interview recently and we were talking about, like, mean comments and how we deal with them. And I said that I, like, will read something and I'll, like, I don't want to let those people into our home, like, you know, like, mess up my peace in my home.
Yeah.
So I'll, like, be, like, stubbornly happy in my own home and not let the comments. And I think the interviewer was like, so, like, angry happy. And I was like, yeah. Angrily happy.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'm going to be happy regardless.
Spitefully
having a great time. Yeah, exactly.
I love that. You guys, I really love talking with you.
This has been great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I feel like I'm like, when can I, how soon is too soon to invite them back? So, hope you've been thinking about it.
Oh, shit. Like, do you have one?
No.
Are we doing one together? Or are we doing...
I think that would be easier.
So, the question is, what is a song that has held you or is like a North Star or that you come back to either as a couple or as individuals? And it can be like light and silly. It does not have to be serious.
A song that has held us that we come back to.
I just literally just name a song I've been liking.
This is the problem. Shane doesn't put any weight. No, Shane doesn't put any weight behind the things he says. I'm serious. Like, yeah. People will be like, what's your favorite movie? And you'll just name movie. And I'll be like, I am sorry, I can't answer that question. Like, I take that extremely seriously. And I would need to think about it for a really long time.
Oh, and we don't have to do this question.
No, we will.
I'm just saying, this is, Shane's just going to list, he's going to list the last song that was played.
Literally. Okay.
It has to be a song, like a real one.
I did you leave all this in. This is a great, authentic look into how we talk to each other. I would have said, before I was told I was not allowed to say this, that recently I've been loving a song called Fortune Teller by Sea Lemon. And it's just
heard it.
I know. But I find a new song and I get really like, oh, I love this.
Yeah.
I listen to it way too much and then I move on to a new one. Right now, that song is bringing me great joy. Oh, I could say more that. I just say more that.
That's not something that holds you.
I don't know how to answer that.
Okay, the horrible song about the dying is one that you come back to, but let's not put that on the playlist.
No, let's put that on the playlist.
Which one is that?
What is it?
It's called Get Better by Alt J. And it's a super sad song about a guy whose wife passes.
Yes,
it's and he's just remembering
so sad
little moments about her. Alt J is incredible. Like, their writing is amazing. But that song will make me cry. I don't cry super easily. That song will make you
He'll
cry.
Put the song on and cry to it. Like, I don't understand Shane. To do that.
Around, like, I should do it right now.
I would never do it right now.
That one. Hannah,
I avoid that song at all costs. Like, I don't want to feel those emotions at all. No, thank you.
Oh, I love a song like that. I'm with you, Shane. Like, I feel that way about Landslide by Fleetwood Mac. That same sort of like the impermanence of life song. I will dive head first into that.
Hannah, you should do Hannah Montana.
No.
Because
I was
that's
gonna
a
do,
yeah.
Yeah, you can do Look Up by Joy Aladikin.
What do you love about that song, Hannah?
It's like one of the first songs that came to mind when you said like a song that you go back to that's just like, oh, like I really like that song. It's like uplifting and like sweet and a little sad. I like that song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't wait to listen to these. I will be going to Spotify immediately and sitting in my tears and my Look Up vibes. You guys, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been great.
You bring so many gifts to the world. And I feel like that question we asked earlier that like, why do you keep doing it? I mean, no pressure. You can opt out at any time, but you have brought so much to people, to our communities, to the world. You're doing so much cool stuff. And I'm so glad that you're here. So thank you.
We really appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you both so much. This has been lovely. And love all your deep questions.
Yeah, amazing questions.
All right, so you will have already accepted our second invitation. Great. Okay. All right.
Come back. It's gonna be no holds barred.
Oh, good.
Okay,
I'm so ready.
Thanks, everybody.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
This podcast is edited and perfected by the most beautiful wizard and my favorite dude, Micah Jones.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.